So good evening, and welcome to the Cyber Zendo. It's good to have you. I'm continuing to comment on this text that I put together with the intention of creating a holistic style of practice. It's called the Elixir of Bodhicitta, and it is a way of, on a daily basis, unifying different elements of the practice. And I think especially what's unusual is often Zen practitioners just sit down and do Zazen. And maybe you chant something like the Heart Sutra that you don't really understand. Or maybe you chant something else in a foreign language. But we don't have such a way of connecting to the spirit of practice and the motivation traditionally. And so I created something, and this is in the influence of the Indo-Tibetan tradition, where they have something called sadhana, where you connect with the view of why you practice and what reality is, as well as doing the practice in its different dimensions. And I've been hearing from some folks who've undertaken this, and anyone who's interested in the text, I'll put my email in later and you can get a copy. So I'm going through this text, and right now I'm at the part connecting with the heart of bodhicitta. You know, an interesting thing you find in the Mahayana teachings is they say that if you don't have the intention to be of benefit in the world, in other words, if we haven't awakened the heart that wants to do something, be something in response to the ragged heartbreak that is living, then you should not be introduced to or practice the teachings of emptiness. If you don't care about living beings, it would be better not to go deeper into the practice, is essentially what they say. Now, this, I think, this is not like, hey, we're going to close the door. This is not like a Buddha bouncer saying, sorry, your ID is no good. You're not sexy enough to come in this club. We only let the sexy ones in. It's not like that, because everybody actually does want to respond to the heartbreak that is this world. Everybody. And at the very least, you're interested in responding to your own suffering. I guarantee it. There's not a single person who in one way or another is not moved to relieve suffering, at least here. And the practice of bodhicitta and the practices of emptiness are empowering us to expand that. I know there are times in my life where I shrink the sphere of my concern very, very small, mostly because I'm afraid I'll be overwhelmed by the suffering of other people. Mostly because I feel like I can't handle really listening, really feeling, really showing up. And I'm not especially defective. And no, neither can you be. This is the human situation. So the deeper teachings on emptiness and the desire to somehow be or do real benefit have to always come together. So a bodhisattva is not necessarily someone who takes on a massive mountain of good deeds, as much as there's somebody who is empowered by the practice of emptiness to be able to live awake in a world that is really quite fucked up. Let's not pull punches. The Buddha never said the world was a beautiful place, actually. He said it's beautiful and terrible. It's beautiful and terrible. And for many people, it's more terrible than beautiful. And we want to shift that equation. So, at this point in the practice, so you've done the breaths, you've done some other reflections, you try to really touch into your own resonance with suffering. And in some ways, this flies in the face of like why some of us are meditating in the first place. We go, wait a sec, I sat down not to touch suffering, but to get away from it. So the first thing I want to say is you don't touch into the point of incapacitating yourself in the practice. This is an art that only you can engage. In some of the old ways of teaching, people would reflect on the suffering of all six realms. That's Buddhist cosmology. Basically, every form of existence has its own flavor of suffering, including the one we're in right now. And you would just imagine it yourself into those scenarios. But as a practice, when you connect with the heart of bodhicitta, you just want to dip into the first noble truth. Just bring to mind the struggles that beings face, including yourself, or maybe primarily yourself. That's why you're practicing. And of course, we can extrapolate that right now I already have suffering, but what if things get more difficult? Then what's going to happen? We're practicing because we care enough, at least for ourselves to start with, to suffer less, to be more free. Now, how long you dwell on that part of the practice, it could be just for a few moments, it could be for longer. So let me make a little slight sidebar and say there's two tiers of practice. And we could call them the affirmative and the prohibitive. The affirmative is living from open, empty clarity. Living from mind essence. In our practice, in our work with teachers, we hope to recognize that, and then we hope to live from that open, empty clarity. And mindfulness just keeps us, let's say, in the groove, in the resting of that. And if this doesn't make any sense right now, it doesn't make any sense. Not a problem. There is a spaciousness. There is an indestructible quality deeper than our ordinary minds that we touch. And if we touch it deeply enough, we can make that the basis of our practice. Some people here are at that place. Most of us, and most of the time, our practice in a way is, I was calling it prohibitive. Let's say it's antidotal. We're working with antidotes. We are intentionally needing to let go of and put aside certain states of mind that are shrouds over our innate freedom. There's a lot of toxic stuff that moves through, subtle and not so subtle. So the antidote is watching the clouds of the mind and doing what it takes to move them along. the affirmative is embodying the sky. Even if we can practice affirmative sometimes, we drop down to the prohibitive. It's similar to saying, sometimes I can rest in open awareness in my sitting, but then I realize I'm too muddled, my mind is too busy, and then I need an object of concentration. There's a parallel here. So this text continues with, how many are there? I think there's four or five, we could call them the four or five putting asides. And I'll read them and then I'm going to comment on them. The first one is, and this of course is prohibitive or the antidotal. Putting aside endless wanting and planning for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations. Putting aside indifference and aloofness towards self and other for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations. Putting aside identifying with my confusion, moods, and emotional afflictions for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations. Putting aside aggression, internal and external, for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations. And then the last one, putting aside inflexibility for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations. So in a sense, we're moving into the space of meditation at this point, and we're trying to really get clear, remind ourselves what it's really about. We need reminders, I think, most of us, about what this is really all about. And so the first one. Now, each phrase, the second part says, for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations. That is kind of a Jogenism, right? In a classical text, it would be for the sake of ending suffering or for the sake of awakening or something like this. But in some ways, those are very abstract words. Many people hear the word awakening and we don't have actually any reference point for that. Or what does it mean to end suffering? Is that like a good bong hit? I don't really suffer then. So these words, they don't actually have so much meat for us. So I'm trying to evoke, well, what might it be like to be awake or to be free from suffering? I think it has something to do with love, beauty, and integrity. Anyways, that's a footnote. This is a Jogenism, the second part. But the first one, putting aside endless wanting and planning. Now we start with this one because it's very easy as super busy people to sit down in the space of meditation, and we've sat down, but the mind that is endlessly planning and wanting has definitely not sat down. We stop, but it hasn't stopped. It's still going. It's like a frictionless wheel for many people. It's still got its momentum. Right? What's underneath endless wanting and planning? Why do we do that? And someone could make a good argument about karmic habits that they simply are frictionless. They're like frictionless wheels that have been set in motion and they're so well oiled that they just keep going. It's what are those things called that, does anyone have one of those TikTok things? It was really popular in the 80s. You'd watch movies in the 80s or the early 90s and always like the snarky CEO would have one of these on his desk. It's these marbles that hit and it creates a reaction on the other side. And so it infinitely goes. It won't stop, I think. So karma has no inbuilt entropy, actually. It won't stop on its own. So this endless wanting and planning, it just is a frictionless wheel. We have to interrupt it. one important way of interrupting is to ask, what's underneath that? Is it armor? Does constant wanting and planning, does it shield us from something? Maybe something we would rather not feel. That could be a valuable, what's the word? Let's just say a valuable mirror to look at your mind and say, why is it doing this? Don't be mad at it, but be curious with it. Why are you doing this? Is it actually practical? If you engage with it as a part, like in parts work, if you talk to the endless planner in people, it'll often be very convinced that it's utterly necessary and that the universe will collapse if it doesn't do its job nearly every moment. And it really believes that. Another way to say it is that ordinary mind is not faith mind. Endless wanting and planning mind is not in touch with a kind of okayness in the present moment. It certainly doesn't believe we're capable of responding spontaneously to life. And so therefore, it fills empty space with endless wanting and planning. So we get curious about it. Putting aside wanting and planning is not saying be satisfied. Sometimes Dharma teachings sound like that. Just be satisfied. Stop wanting stuff. All you wanters. All you wanters out there. Stop wanting stuff. It's not so much that we just decide to be satisfied or that we actually find contentment in practice. Actually, it's more that we give up the search for it. In our Dharma condition, we're neither contented nor discontented. You can't find contentment or discontent. We're just here. So we don't so much find contentment as we give up the search for it. Now, in meditation, this has a very minute kind of quality. I was sitting, I think, yesterday, and I noticed this quality of discontent. And I was curious, why is there discontent? And I realized there were some sensations in my body, and they weren't terrible, but I wasn't willing to really relax into them. They were uncomfortable enough that I was subtly rejecting them. That subtle rejection was all it took for there to be discontent. The other side of that is I decided to relax into those very sensations. That's what it takes. Can you always do that? No. Might you be able to do that more? That's a good question. So this part of the practice is saying we're putting aside wanting. We're not crushing it. We're not squelching it. This is not an anti-desire lineage. Such lineages are out there that say, actually, no, that is Buddhism. You're supposed to give up and kind of get rid of all desire like a dried up turd or something. Maybe a dried up sponge. Yeah, turd is not, yeah, right. Thank you, Sarah. Turd is not a good metaphor. Not a good metaphor. But anyways, we're not an anti-desire lineage. This isn't saying that wanting is bad. In the Bodhisattva teachings, they say that if you cut off the vein of desire, you lose your compassion. There's actually a very interesting koan. It says, why does the bodhisattva not cut off the red thread? The red thread is desire in its sexual form, in its sensual form, in its agapic form, in its brotherhood and sisterhood form. Why does the bodhisattva not cut off the red thread? That's a beautiful investigation. So putting aside endless wanting and planning, if we do that long enough and we rest in our essential clarity, when wanting and planning re-arise, we see it in a different light. That's one of the reasons that stillness, quiescence, we could say, is a tool in the Dharma. Because through it, we can know things anew. We can know things differently. Many of you here have gone to retreat and come back into your life, and you see that life differently. You see the people differently. Maybe you see some aspect of a relationship with somebody a little differently. You couldn't before. You were too close. The mind was too activated by whatever it was. You come back with some clarity, there's a possibility of a new perspective. By putting aside endless wanting and planning for a time, we might sort our wanting out into shallow and deep. I can say that for myself. I can't say that for you. But I can say for myself, I have desires that are shallow and desires that are deep. I don't always pick the deep over the shallow. I don't actually think the shallow is less good than the deep, but the deep is deep and the shallow is shallow. That's just me. Or we could say, putting aside wanting long enough, we might be able to sort out ordinary discontent from deeper desire. Or maybe our everyday discontent is a deeper desire and it's asking something of us. What is it asking? So as a kind of life reflection, you could see that this, you could really dig into this particular reflection in the text. In the sitting situation, the idea is that you put aside, at least for a moment, endless wanting and planning. You remind yourself that it is to be interrupted. It is to be press the pause button. The next reflection, and if you're doing the text, the suggestion is that you're reciting these out loud if you can before you move into the main body of the sitting. The next one is putting aside indifference and aloofness towards self and other for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations. You know, talking earlier about bodhicitta and emptiness and how those go together really is a very similar principle here. We're working to be open to it all. Why are we indifferent to certain people, situations, things in our life? Why does that happen? We're working to be open to it all. Our empty clarity has this capacity. Our emotional heart doesn't. Now here we go into just Jogen opinions. This is my opinion as a teacher and as a Dharma student. Our ordinary emotional heart cannot be open to everything. There comes a point where I feel that I will be crushed by the pain of life. Or even the beauty of life could be crushing. The ordinary emotional heart cannot just take everything. This is why people dissociate. but our empty clarity that comes from practice empowers the heart to be able to be open to it all, or to work in that direction. In other words, in my opinion, the heart needs empty clarity, this phrase I'm using for our true nature, to fulfill its potential. The old masters would say that wisdom and compassion have to be united. If one is lacking or out of balance, then we have problems. Many Dharma practitioners are indifferent to themselves, and it keeps them from really engaging their practice. You've heard me say, we kind of want to be free. We kind of want to know our true nature. We 80%, 70%. But there's some amount that's like, eh, whatever. Who am I to wake up, or why shouldn't I suffer? Maybe you have some version of that. We're aloof or indifferent to our own flourishing. And I don't know about your like professional or emotional relational flourishing, but at least our spiritual flourishing, most of us are actually indifferent to that. We don't fully care. We're aloof from the possibility. It seems like that's for other people. Other people have that capacity. They're extraordinary. And we kind of offload the task on the saints of the world or whatever. Because in sitting down for meditation each day, it's very easy for you to, and me, I'm not any exception, to not fully engage. It's almost as if we don't take it seriously. We've sort of bought the ticket, but we're not really like taking the seat at the concert, or we're inspired by the promise of the Dharma, but when we sit down, it's as if we excuse ourselves. No, not this setting. Not now. Maybe 5 years from now, maybe 10 years from now. Those of you who've been to Sesshin, that's part of why it has a kind of ferociousness. It's trying to get you serious about your own liberation. It's trying to say, no, you can really wake up to a great degree. You have to not be indifferent to it. So on the cushion, we don't want to half-heartedly engage. And if we are half-hearted, which happens, or less than full-hearted, let's get that on the radar. Let's get aware that we're doing that, right? The way I see it is, if it's going to be half-hearted, you might as well not do it. Actually do something else that's pleasurable. But if you're doing it, whether it's 5 minutes or 20 minutes, see if you can really do it. See what it's like to really concentrate, to really let go, to really open your heart. It's a work in progress. The putting aside indifference and aloofness for Bodhisattva practitioner, this is raw. I mean, if we really take in the degree to which we're indifferent, it can be a devastating perception. You know, when I think about opening my heart fully, the first thought that comes up is, oh yeah, but I'll be inconvenienced. I'll be bothered by someone else's distress. I don't have time for that. We've got to be working on this. We've got to increase our willingness to be, not disrupt our lives completely, but inconvenienced, at least with seeing what we see, at least with feeling what we feel. I believe that the COVID era shifted many of us into an increasingly insular and capsulized life. I'm sometimes embarrassed that I could. Now, right now it's snowing here in Michigan, right? It's bad weather. But even before that, I don't actually have to leave my room. I could have someone like put food through my window and have Jeff Bezos bring me some books and get entertained. I don't even have to leave this chair. I could probably get a camping toilet and just like go into the corner, come right back. It's like, it's endless and it's absurd. Technology, especially through classism, right? Capitalism, definitely racism has something to do with it. We can be so insular in our lives now, so profoundly insular. That is something to reckon with. It's a cultural force. There's no simple answer to that. But that's something to reckon with, because to wake up means to be free from indifference, at least for moments at a time. Consider, or here's something that I have arrived at as an important consideration. Consider there to be an amount of pain intake, loved ones, world, and self, that is fruitful for staying awake and real. There is a fruitful amount of intake of pain that is necessary to be an authentic human. Maybe there's a sweet spot of how much of that actually, whether that's personal challenge, world challenge, not necessarily separate, I don't want to get into quantity because you can't quantify it. You can't say, well, tomorrow I'm going to try 7.8 degrees of suffering. But there's a certain amount of engagement with the real conventional situation that actually is a spiritual boon that we need. One of the training methods of Great Vow is to throw somebody into a situation where they're really at their edge. I didn't even know how to boil water or scramble an egg, more or less, and then they made me the cook. Before I knew it, I was cooking for 80 or 90 people at these big retreats. And I got so stressed out that I got shingles one year. This is a long time ago now. Shingles is a kind of viral thing that only happens when you're really stressed. I was really stressed. I had to really find some deep resource in order to not collapse into self-pity. It was one of the most transformative years of my life. Because I had the right amount of suffering proportion to how much practice I was doing. So an antiseptic life is spiritually dead. That's what I'm saying. An antiseptic life is not spiritually lively, and we might already know this at some level. And thus we do things like go on dates or I don't know, many things we could do. So I guess I'm going to continue with these next week. Next week, I'll continue with putting aside identifying with my confusion, moods, and emotional afflictions for the sake of love, beauty, integrity, and all my relations.